So welcome back, everybody. I understand it's been a really great morning, and clearly we've got some pretty interesting things to discuss this afternoon. My name's Pauline Blight-Johnston, and I'll be your chair for the next two sessions, and I'm very much looking forward to what we're going to learn together. So it's my pleasure to introduce the next session, which is called Responding to Paradigm Changes. We all know risk management's pretty tricky at the best of times, but when the ground's changing under your feet as you speak, it takes it to a whole other level, and that's the environment we're in today. The pace of change and where this is all going to go is something that's been quite uncharted in many generations. And so as we grapple with what it means to put in place fit-for-purpose risk management systems, which we are still learning in many ways, and the ground's changing underneath us, we need to be very adaptive and really be able to think ahead. So we're fortunate today that we have some people who are going to help us with that. First, the first of the sessions will focus on the practical considerations of how you put in place and how you consider risk management in a quickly changing environment. And secondly, we'll look at the impact of one particular paradigm change we're dealing with, which is low interest rates and what that impact that has on risk management. At the end, there'll be opportunity to ask questions, so try to make a note of those and keep them for the end so we can have a really vibrant conversation. So our first speaker this afternoon is Stephen Britt. Stephen's currently Senior Manager of Insurance and Investment Risk at IAG, where he brings, I'm told, an appropriate consideration of insurance entity requirements to the investments of the group's domestic and foreign insurance entities. Prior to joining IAG, prior to this particular role, Stephen had various roles in the investments and capital management functions of the group. Prior to IAG, he worked as a consultant for an international consulting firm, advising on investments and capital management, specialising in superannuation funds, general insurance and regulatory authorities. Stephen's an actuary, a CFA chartered analyst, a keen cyclist and a father of two grown-up kids. But before we meet Stephen, I will introduce... Following Stephen will be Warren Dresner. Warren is the head of broking at Willis Re in Australia and is responsible for client management, broking and production across Australia, New Zealand and the Pacific Islands. He has reinsurance advisory, placement and analytics experience in Australia, New Zealand, the UK, Europe and the USA, covering a range of classes of business, including property, casualty, credit and surety, builder's warranty and lender's mortgage insurance. Warren is also a fellow of the Actuaries Institute and holds a Bachelor of Commerce degree as well. So with that, thank you, Stephen, over to you.
Thank you, Pauline, for those kind words. Just want to make sure I know how this goes. There we go. And you see that? Yep. Okay. I still haven't got used to glasses after 10 years. So as poor Pauline has said, the focus of this presentation is on responding to paradigm change, and my task is to talk about practical ways of dealing with and understanding the changing external environment, and particularly how you might incorporate those in the risk models you may be choosing to use to help you with your risk management techniques. I've been told I'm not allowed to be very technical in this presentation. So straight after lunch, I'm meant to be talking in a non-technical way about quite a technical role of dealing with the unknown. So, yes, I'm going to be talking about three things. First of all, I'm going to be talking about paradigm shift and regime shift. I'm going to build a distinction between the two, because when we're assessing change, it's pretty good to have this framework to help us understand what's going on. I'm going to apply a pretty standard way of dealing with risk management to bring to the topic. And then I am going to give some practical points on how to model regime shift when you don't have very good data. I'd just like to say that the opinions are my own and don't necessarily reflect the views of either my employer or the institute. And the typos, other than the one that's currently on the screen, are my fault too. So, just moving on. That's not right. Where's... Okay, here's where I panic. Ryan, yes? Excellent. That's just... Yeah, these slides are really good, so don't look at them just yet. But they are really good, and I think you'll enjoy what Warren has had to say. So like I was saying, I wanted to talk about paradigm shift and regime shift, and the reason I want to do this is that when you're dealing with a changing world, I think you want to work out, is it us that are doing the changes? Is it us that are doing the changing? Or are we responding to change that's out there? Because as innovative companies, we should be doing both. And so I've got a couple of definitions courtesy of Wikipedia. I'm going to talk about paradigm shift, where I'm talking about fundamental change in the basic concepts and experimental practices of a scientific discipline, like enterprise risk management should be. And I talk about this is how do we do things around here now? So it's talking about changes in tools, techniques that are used, and the fine samples are quantum physics, social media, where people do things now, and it means that some of the data that we're going to be looking at has changed, but it's the change in the way that people are doing is changing the way that the world is behaving. And artificial intelligence is a big one at the moment. So that's paradigm shift, changes in the way that people are doing things. Regime shift, and this comes from climate science, I think, where you talk about epochs and so forth. Large, abrupt, persistent changes in the structure and the function of a system. That is, the data's changed, and so we need to actually respond to the change in the data. And the two samples are Earth's average temperature and low interest rates are the two that we'll pick up on here. I say that there are two things. There's the data has changed, what are you going to do about it? Or people are doing things, so we're not sure how we should respond, and we don't know how the world's going to respond. Are we still going to be able to sell insurance with people selling social media or not? We don't have our data yet. We do know people are doing things different, so we should be pre-planning our responses. So it's a risk management seminar. So how do you deal with risk management? First thing you do is, can you recognise a regime shift? If you can recognise it, how can you assess it? And by assess, I say take a look at it and work out whether it's worth trying to build a model for. Once you've got the model, how can you manage the system or exploit it? So sometimes regime shift is really easy. I've got two slides here. On the left, it's interest rate data. This is the 10-year bond yield going back about 30 years. And what I did was to draw some lines through what I consider to be the regimes there. It's called chi by I. And so we've got falling interest rate regimes, and we've got constant interest rate regimes. And just looking at the data, we had falling interest rates for many, many years. People actually got used to learning about falling interest rates in equity, in investments. That meant you bought equities because they loved falling interest rates. Then during the 2000s, we had constant interest rates. You learn how to deal with constant interest rates again. Then they start falling. you start to learn to love falling interest rates again. And the last one, I don't know, are interest rates falling or are they low? We'll find out. According to my scientific line, the last one is constant, so I'm going for relatively constant interest rates for the next few years. On the right-hand side, this is data from the Bureau of Meteorology, and it's something called the AconSat data. So it's the average temperature of Australia's land mass measured from 1910 through to 2010. And the grey line is a 10-year moving average. Very, very easy way to pick up a trend. Just take a rolling average. You look at the data, I'd suggest that it shows that we had a regime which was flat, relatively flat temperature. Now we've got rising interest rates in the current regime. Those two things are evidence of regime shift, and we're not being overly cute in the way that we're choosing to model of them. But there are two regimes that we need to do something about. Now, when you've got data, you've got a way to recognise regime shift, and as you could see there, usually it's blindingly obvious that the world's changed, and the data tells you that you should do something about it. Unfortunately, that's kind of the horse bolted sort of thing. And so what I wanted to do, since I can't talk about technical stuff, I have a folksy anecdote for you. About 10 years ago, I was at a conference, and the CIO of the Japanese Postal Pension Fund, the largest super fund in the world, was talking about the Japonification of the world. And his thesis was that Japan went through a development stage. Once it developed, fertility rates fell, as they have across the world. That caused a demographic bulge. Do you guys know what a demographic profile is? On the left, how old are people? You've got these two bulges there. As more people enter the retirement age or as they get older, lower per-unit productivity, you don't get the increase in population boom for GDP growth, and that leads to lower interest rates. And his thesis was that Japan, having had that lower fertility rate earlier, was a leading indicator of where interest rates are going to go for the rest of the world. And I remember 10 years ago, just at the end of that flat regime that we had, thinking, nah, I don't believe it. But it was, we had lower interest rates. There's a demographic imperative for those, in my opinion, and I think that we're going to get them continuing in the future. The point here is that, yes, you want to actually respond to the data, but ideally what you've got to do as risk managers is try and get to the paradigm shift before the data tells you that there's a regime shift and see if you can cope with it. So recognising, assessing, this is the most important part of regime shift, because the world's changing all the time. Sometimes it's important, sometimes it's not. And when there is a regime shift, what you generally know is that your standard tools are not necessarily going to help you with getting a handle on it. This is basically from a paper I remember reading about 20 years ago, and I don't remember the paper, unfortunately, but it was great. This stuff has stuck with me for a long time. And it's talking about the quantitative aspect of risk management. And the thesis there was that you need three aspects to your to your quantitative risk management. The first is you need a model that can give you an indication of the sort of risks you've got. I've called it a VAR model because it was a finance paper. And the idea there is that the model tells you how much risk you've got, and that's great. But as when you have regime shifts, of course, the model's calibrated to data. The data's different now, so you can't trust the model. So you have a model, but you can't use it to assess what you're going to do. Next one, which is not quite so bad, whenever you're using a quantitative risk model for your risk assessment, you should always be either presenting to the people who are using or as model users, asking what are the key drivers of the risk that this model is showing. And again, in finance, they're called the Greeks. If something changes a little bit, how much risk does that change? So if you're a life insurer writing a lot of very long dated insurance contracts with guaranteed interest rates, and interest rates shift a bit, it causes a lot of pain. If the incidence of driving, if there's more deaths because people aren't paying attention at the wheel, it doesn't move things so much. So if you understand your model and you've got your Greeks, you can say, okay, I think that interest rates are going to go down a fair bit. My model tells me that a small change is going to have a small impact. Multiply that by the large change, and that might tell you whether the model, the regime shift, is actually going to be relevant to you. Problem with that is that, again, there's an implicit assumption that the model can deal with very large shifts based on small shifts. And since it's regime shift, so the world isn't moving the same way, it's highly unlikely that that's going to be the case. So you can't trust your model to tell you what's going to happen with a regime shift. You can't trust the Greeks that you should be getting as a part of your risk reporting. And that leaves you with your stress testing. And here's where you say, well, we know that interest rates are going to fall. What's causing it? What are the other factors at play? And so what does it mean for my business? And that's the only way you can really assess whether a regime shift is going to be relevant to you. And the important thing here is that if you do your stress testing well, you've identified the mitigants that you may be bringing to bear. You've assessed whether they're likely to work under the new regime. So not only do you have an indication as to whether your regime shift is important and needs to be considered carefully, you've also got a head start on what you can do about it afterwards. Okay. So that leads us to, if we have identified a regime shift and if we have assessed it and decided that it's something that we want to reflect in models in future, what are some of the practical things that you can do to bring them into your models? And first one is, while this may be new for us, has it happened somewhere else? And something like falling interest rates fell in Japan well and truly before anywhere else in the world, as we're going to find out shortly. And so to the extent that the Japanese experience is a precursor for us, we can take a look at how the world behaved in Japan since that falling interest rates, make a call as to whether that's applicable for us. We can use that insight when we're building our models. Here's one of my favourites is, has some other field solved this sub-model? So I'm an actuary and a chartered financial analyst, and most of my life I've been talking to the actuaries about fairly plain vanilla finance concepts and bringing those to bear to the actuarial problems. Then I go to the other side and I talk to the finance people about actuarial problem solving. And so I've been able to bring skills and models from a related field or an unrelated field to the problem at hand. So this was, sorry, the first one I should have said is, having assessed it, do we need a model? Is this model risk sufficiently important that we do need to reflect it in our model? And interest rates and general insurance companies are an interesting aspect. If we think about interest rates for our GI company, are they a really important driver of risk for us? To the extent that we can price our short tail contracts to cope with the reduced yield that we're expecting from our investments, or as is consistent with lower interest rates, investors have a lower expected return from economic activity. Interest rates aren't a particularly important driver of the profitability of a general insurance company writing predominantly short tail lines. So we may need to model it, but when you're considering climate change and automated vehicle driving and so forth, in the list of regime shifts, it's pretty much down there towards the bottom. And the last thing is, if you're modelling regime shift or you're trying to capture a system that's been going through regime shift, of course, if we understand the drivers, then we have a real head start on driving the of understanding how to model these things. The one that comes to mind is, again, interest rates, Japan. You've got in Japan, you've got that aging population. Does that apply to Australia? Probably not. We have a far higher immigration. The bubble is nearly so bad. So I'd suggest that if you're looking for how to cope with or how the world's going to happen in interest rate sense, you don't necessarily need to look at the Japanese experience if you're an Australian. Okay, so I was asked to talk about modelling and assessing regime shift, and I wasn't allowed to be technical, but I wanted to play with some data. So we had the 10-year bond data, and I thought I would ask the question, well, if we might find it difficult to pick up turning points and pick up regime shift ourselves, can't we just throw the data at the computer and see how it goes? So I did a couple of things. I got the 10-year bond data and I threw it at my computer and I said, build a neural net and show me how well your neural net can describe the data. And I chose a neural net because I don't really know much about them. But what I do know is that the data is not very suitable for a neural net. So on the right, you've got the output of a neural net trying to understand that interest rate data. I'm not seeing regime shift there. And if you look at the last observation, you can show that the neural net is actually taking quite a big bet on increase in interest rates at the moment, which may be right, may be wrong, but I don't see how the data could drive that. So I'd say that artificial intelligence isn't quite there for picking up regime shift yet, so maybe we have some more jobs. On the right-hand side, what I did was I gave the computer a hint. I said, sometimes interest rates are falling, sometimes they're flat. Here's the data, you tell me where the turning points are. And it did a much better job there. So the computers can certainly help us, but they still do need a bit of guidance. in dealing with regime shift. Now, the next part is having recognised, assessed, modelled maybe is how you manage or how you make a buck out of this. And I'll be handing over to Warren in a moment. But for those of you who are technically minded, there's some references here. The top one is an excellent paper by a guy called Mark Christman on how you recognise regime shift in data. So you can feed a whole lot of data in it and it can tell you when the world is changing, which is useful. The next one is a paper by a lady called Mary Hardy, who's a Canadian professor somewhere. She's an actuary and she's built a model of regime shift, and she's applied that to equity market data, but I've actually nicked her model and used it in identifying pricing regimes in insurance market. Is the reinsurance market hard or soft? And for superimposed inflation, are we actually in a high superimposed inflation, low superimposed inflation? And how do we transition between the two? So I can recommend that. In the interest of full disclosure, the 10-year bond yield data came from FactSet, but if you want to play with it, it's on the RBA and the climate change and the climate data set is up there too. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Warren, who's going to show us how to exploit regime shift to make a lot of money.
Thanks Stephen. So you've seen all these slides, so maybe we can just go straight to questions. Huh? So I'm going to talk about insurance-linked securities and their impact on the reinsurance market as an example of regime shift and ultimately paradigm shift. So insurance-linked securities are basically investments where the return is linked to some sort of insurance contract or insurance outcome. And what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years is a massive growth in the ILS market in the reinsurance world. And I'll touch on that in a moment. I'll show you some evidence of that. But the first question is, why have we seen so much growth? And it's for a few reasons, really. The first, as you can see on the left-hand side, is falling interest rates. Since the financial crisis, we've just seen interest rates falling globally everywhere. And what this has done is it's made investors say, where else can we generate some absolute returns? And increasingly, they're looking at alternative investments, exotics, and reinsurance is very much one of those alternative investments. What the right-hand graph shows is that not only can they generate absolute returns, potentially, in reinsurance, but the returns are not correlated to the rest of their investments. So the yellow line there is a Merrill Lynch bond index. You can see it's been pretty much flat in the last couple of years. The blue line is the S&P 500, so that's gone up and down. And the green is a Swiss Re cap bond index, which shows two things. One, that returns have been positive over time. But secondly, that it's just not correlated to the equities and not correlated to the bonds. And that's a huge attraction for investors. If they can generate a return in our industry, in reinsurance, and it's not correlated with the rest of their portfolio, that adds significant value. The other big change that we've seen is that through financial ingenuity, the capital providers, the asset investors, have managed to get closer to the risk. So what I mean by this is that if you go back 5 years ago, these investors thought it would be a good idea to start to invest in reinsurance. But the products that they were willing to provide were very different from the products that the buyers wanted to buy. So, for example, these capital providers, they wanted absolute returns. They wanted non-correlated returns. We talked about that. But they were very much only wanting to take on risk when it was well-modeled risk. So they wanted parametric products. They wanted to say, if there's a 5.0 earthquake, we'll pay you out this much money. If it's a 6.0, we'll pay you out more. They also only wanted to look at perils that were well-modeled. So cyclone and earthquake, we tend to have good industry models for them, but not so much for flood, for bushfire, for hail. They also, very important for the investors, is liquidity. All of their other investments, they can trade in and out of them. They wanted to invest in reinsurance, but they wanted to retain liquidity. But what the buyers want was pretty much the opposite of everything I've just talked about. So they wanted indemnity. Buyers of reinsurance, they when they pay out a claim, they want to know that their reinsurance is going to work. So they don't want parametric coverage. They want indemnity coverage. They also want all perils cover, particularly in a highly regulatory environment like ours. They need coverage for hail, for flood, for bushfire. Sometimes they want multi-year cover as well. So there were a bunch of different things that the buyers wanted that were different to what the sellers were willing to give 4 or 5 years ago. But slowly over time, the investors have changed their approach and found ways of providing cover and overcoming these obstacles. So this flexibility has created huge opportunity for them to grow. And so what we've seen is this upward trajectory of growth. So this shows that at the end of 2016, there was about $75 billion of ILS investment in the reinsurance market. Today, that number is probably over $80 billion, could even be $85 billion. And to put that in context, there's probably about $300 billion of cat reinsurance bought globally. Most of this is invested in cat reinsurance. So that represents maybe 20%, 25% of the market. It's actually made a material impact on the market. The other thing that the graph shows is that there's been a change in the type of product that these guys are providing. So the purple represents liquid ILS, which is really cat bonds. So these are bonds that the investors can trade in and out of. You can see that going back to the early 2000s to the late 90s, it was all about cat bonds. But in the last 4 or 5 years, there's much more blue and much more yellow on that graph. The blue represents what's called illiquid ILS. This is basically private deals or collateralized reinsurance. So in these deals, the investors actually have no liquidity at all. And the yellow is sidecars, which is effectively just quota shares. So putting their capacity as a quota share next to a traditional reinsurer, acting as a sidecar, I guess, to their venture. Now, what's interesting about this segment of the market, particularly from my point of view as a broker, is that the way that these markets look at risk is very different from the traditional reinsurance world. So if we think about a traditional reinsurer, they're global. They tend to be overweight in the US just because the US is the biggest and the wealthiest buyer of reinsurance. So most of the exposure is in that part of the world. They've got the ability, they're predominantly equity funded and they're rated. Most importantly, they've got ratings from S&P, AM Best, which means that buyers of reinsurance trust them. So you can go to a reinsurer, you say, well, you're double A rated. I trust that you're going to be there to pay a claim when I come calling. That gives them the ability to leverage. So they might have $1 billion of capital, but if you sum up every single reinsurance deal that they do, it'll add up to much more than $1 billion because they know that the chances are they're not going to have a claim on every single one of their contracts. They crave diversification for this reason. It actually makes their business better if they can generate a diversified pool of risk. Now they might want, say, 10% return on that diversified pool of capital. If we look at the alternative model, the ILS model, to date it's predominantly in the US, but that's changing. Increasingly they're looking at international areas like Australia, like Japan. Predominantly it's cat focused, as I said, but again, that's changing. They're looking more and more at non-cat lines, at life insurance as well. These guys do not have an ability to leverage. They're not rated. So you might be dealing with a fund here who's got $1 trillion, but they don't have a rating, they don't have a track record, and clients might say, we know you've got lots of money, but we don't know that you're actually going to pay the claim when I come calling. So what they do is they say, well, okay, we'll take on your risk and we'll take our potential downside and go and put that money in a bank. They fully collateralize the risk. What that means is they can't actually leverage their capital. So if they've got $1 billion that they want to put into this space, they have to go and deposit money into a bunch of bank accounts representing all of the limit that they've put out. They can't leverage their capital. So diversification is largely ignored. Now, a lot of this money is coming from pension funds who have a long-term outlook, who tend to, they're not hedge funds. They're not looking for massive returns all the time. They might only want, say, 5% return. So if you look at the simple example at the bottom of the economics behind writing a deal, the traditional approach might be, we've modeled the risk, we think the expected losses, the lay is $100 and it's in the USA. We've modelled the risk and the expected losses might be, we think they're $25. According to our capital allocation model, we think we need to put $70 aside to support this risk. Because we want to generate a 10% return, that means our cost of capital is going to be $7. So the cost for us of riding that risk is $32. The ILS investor will look at it slightly differently. So they will assess the risk as well. They might come up with a different view of risk, but let's assume that they don't. Let's assume they also think the expected losses are $25. They need to take the full $100, put it in a bank account. They want to generate 5% return on that money. So the cost for them of riding that business is only $30. So what this shows is in a peak territory like the USA or any kind of risk, whether the allocated capital is actually very high and close to the limit, the ILS model starts to become more attractive. And this kind of explains why the ILS has grown so much in the US. Let's pretend this example was in Australia. So in Australia, the traditional approach, they might say, well, expected loss is still $25. The capital allocated all of a sudden becomes really low. So because Australia is not a peak territory, they might only allocate $10 to that risk. The cost of capital is then only $1, and the cost of running that business is only $26. From the ILS perspective, nothing changes. They don't care that it's in Australia. So all of a sudden, in Australia, the traditional market appears to be much cheaper. They've got a competitive advantage. So what's been the impact and what's been the response of the reinsurance industry to this new money that's coming in that appears to be more attractive in certain parts of the world? Well, I guess they went through various emotional states of the market, and the first was denial. So reinsurers basically said there's no value in this new product. They started scaremongering and talking about all the downsides of dealing with these people. So for instance, you can't trust them. We've been around for 100 years. Why would you go and do a deal with someone that's actually got no track record in the industry? Or they might say, yes, the money's in a bank, but what's the trust agreement like? Is it a watertight trust agreement? When you have a claim, are you actually going to be able to call on that money? That was the initial response. Then it turned to fear. Reinsurers saying, starting to see that they're losing market share in the US, and the US is where they were generating most of their profits. So traditional reinsurers started to protect their patch. They started to offer terms and conditions that they just wouldn't have offered before. They started to be more flexible. They started to lower their prices even more. So they actually, the market was already soft. Rates were falling because there was all this new capital coming into the market. Supply was outweighing demand. But then traditional reinsurers started to feed on this frenzy and actually soften the market even further. Then the next step was opportunity. Reinsurers decided, well, maybe we can partner with some of these funds. Maybe we can go to our clients and say, well, we can offer you reinsurance using our paper, or we can offer you reinsurance on behalf of someone else. They went to the funds and said, we've got client relationships, we've got lots of experience, good people who know how to underwrite risk. Why don't we underwrite the risk on your behalf? And they started to see opportunity in this space. And then finally, efficiency came into it. Reinsurers realized that they can actually tap into this capital and lower their own cost of capital. So they can, in effect, become the incubators of this capital. Everyone wins that way. The investors get to have a piece of the reinsurance market, and the reinsurers get to stay involved in the chain of command. And a great example of that is Renaissance Re. So RenRe are one of the more sophisticated reinsurance companies based in Bermuda, and they've really been a pioneer in this space. So they've really, they were one of the first ones to tap into this third-party capital, the ILS capital. So these are just two pictures out of their investor presentations. The one on the left shows that they're telling their shareholders they will have a superior portfolio for two reasons. One, they've got the most desirable risk, so they got great risk selection just because they're the smartest and they got the best underwriters. But two, because they got the most efficient capital. And on the right-hand side, the detail is not really important, but you can see that the left bar is their own capital, but then the green and the purple, they've got a certain amount of capital at their disposal that is other people's money. So they're writing business on behalf of Da Vinci Re, Top Layer Re, Medici, Upsilon, and some other ones as well. And if you added up all the pieces, you'd see that about half of the capital is RenRe capital, and about a half is on behalf of investors. So what this new capital has done, you can see that it's actually changed the way that reinsurers are behaving. And it really is generating regime change, but also a paradigm shift. Reinsurance, as I mentioned, it's all about supply and demand for capital. So with all of this supply coming into the market, rates have been falling. We've been in a prolonged soft reinsurance market for a long time now. And it means that rates and margins are just not what they used to be. So what this graph tries to show is, shows historical ROE for the industry over time. It's a little bit complicated, but I'll explain. So if you follow the purple line, that is the combined ratio that the industry required to generate a 15% ROE at various points in time. The yellow line is the combined ratio needed to generate a 12% return. So if we focus on the period in the late 80s, that's what I call the 15% ROE era. So if you look at the purple line, reinsurers could have reported combined ratios of 102, 103%, and they still would have generated a 15% ROE. It was quite easy to generate great returns in those days. If you focus on the early 2000s, to generate a 15% ROE, you probably would have needed a combined ratio in the low 90s, which is quite tough. So reinsurers were generally reporting about 95% or so, and that generated a 12% return. But if you look today, in the single digit era, to generate a 15% return, you probably need a combined ratio in the 80s, in the low 80s, which is almost impossible. To generate a 12% return, you'd probably need high 80s, which again is not very possible. So what is possible and what reinsurers are doing is generating combined ratios in the mid 90s, which gives ROEs of say 8%. So not only are reinsurers changing the way that they're building up their capital, changing the way they manage their capital, but they're also having to deal with a lower return environment, all while customers are probably more demanding than ever. It's not like they can drop their standards. So overall, when capital was scarce, those who had capital were kings. They could charge what they want, they could generate great returns. But in today's world, capital is no longer scarce. There's a surplus of capital. So reinsurers are forced to look for value-adding services in other ways. The ILS market has become a meaningful part of the industry. So as I mentioned, it's probably about 25% of the industry out there, and it looks like it's here to stay. We've had a series of hurricanes in the US recently, and there's a lot of talk right now about what the ILS market's going to do. It might be that some flee, it might be that some stay. We know that there's a lot of money sitting in the wings waiting for rates to go up so that they can come into the industry and grow their participation. But in general, I think it's here to stay. And reinsurers have adapted. So reinsurers have now finally embraced this capital to lower their own cost of doing business. And what that does is bring a new paradigm for the way that the industry operates. So I'll pass over to Pauline and we can take any questions.
Thank you. And thank you to Stephen and Warren for bringing your expertise to us. You clearly know a whole lot more than we could hope to take in such a short period of time. But now we have a few minutes for questions. So if anybody has any questions of these two experts, now's your moment. I'm going to kick off with one then. As I was watching your presentation, Warren, it struck me that the big difference between the reinsurance market and the ILS market was the return requirement. So the assumption that the reinsurer was looking for 10% and the ILS providers were happy to effectively take on the same risk for 5%. Why do they have such different return requirements?
Well, I guess there are a few. It's not really apples with apples. So it's the reinsurers want 10% of a diversified pool of capital, and they're largely equity funded. So they have to report to shareholders who are looking for these higher returns. The ILS market, it's 5% maybe, but it's an investor base in terms of the asset allocation. They're dealing with a pension fund. They're not dealing with shareholders. So depending on what the strategy of the pension fund might be, it just depends whether they want a low-risk, low-return profile or a high-risk, high-return profile. So I talked about the ILS market as if it was one market, but it's actually a very diverse pool of investors. But there are some of them that like that low-risk, low-return profile, and they are looking for returns as low as 5%.
Basically enables you to access a different pool of investors.
Sorry, I'd just say a cat bond is a bond and the people who are buying it are expecting bond-like returns and they've got equity somewhere. Reinsurer is an equity manager, so the higher volatility comes with the higher required return.
Anyone else? Now, a potentially self-interested question. Do either of you see much of the cat bond market developing in the life insurance sector?
There are cat bonds that have been done in the life sector, mainly extreme mortality. So there definitely is potential for it. I think what we've seen in recent times is the ILS market was so successful at growing in the US cat market that they basically hit their peak of how far they can grow, and they're starting to look for other areas to grow. Life is definitely one of those areas. I guess if you go back to what the sellers want, they're going to have their list. They want the risk to be very well modelled. They want it to be independently verified. It needs to be short tail as well. So maybe there are some restrictions on products, but they're definitely interested.
Talking about turning to paradigm shifts, one of the other paradigm shifts, of course, that we're living through that you identified, Stephen, is climate change. Do you think that's also an opportunity for insurers?
Yes, I do. If you're a life insurance company, the opportunities on the investment side is to fund the infrastructure that needs to be built. So. Sorry about that. If you're a life insurance company, there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built and owned, and I'd say lifees tend to be the natural owners of those. If you're a general insurer, I think there are opportunities, but it's much harder to find where they are. If you're writing one-year contracts, then you really don't want to own a windmill with a life of 25 years. So you've got to exploit some other opportunities.
Hello, question for, I guess, either of you. In terms of kind of paradigm changes or regime changes that could be coming up that the general insurance industry could take advantage of over the kind of coming decades, are there anything, or maybe over the coming decade, is there anything you can kind of think of or that you're aware of that you're kind of keeping an eye on?
One that comes to mind is InsurTech. Everyone's talking about InsurTech, and that's definitely an opportunity for the industry. It's just what it's going to look like and whether it's a disruptor or... I actually think with InsurTech it could be very much like that emotional cycle that the ILS went on. First, there's denial of the traditional reinsurers, but finally it's probably going to be embracement and partnership between bricks and mortar and some of these InsurTech guys. But that's definitely a potential paradigm shift.
I guess the one that comes to mind is the disintermediation of the general insurance value chain, where people who underwrite may not necessarily be the best claims managers, may not be the natural owners of the risk. So there is scope for the... there is a potential regime paradigm shift there with different people underwriting, claims managing and holding risk, which is what's happened in the cat space with the ILS bonds.
Yes, we have a question at the back.
Brett Riley from Arch. Question for both of you, but probably more for Warren. How sticky do you think the ILS capital is if we get a normalisation of interest rates? And I guess my personal view is I think it's going to take a while, and certainly somewhere like Australia, with the level of indebtedness, certainly the household sector, there's a limit to how far interest rates can go up, I think, before consumption and people pull back on expenditure. But let's say we got a normalisation of where things were in the early to mid-2000s, pre-GFC. How much do you think would stick around? Would we see some of that pension and hedge fund money going back to maybe where they were before?
It's a question that gets asked a lot. And I think the most important thing to realise is that that $75, $80 billion is coming from all sorts of different sources. There are hedge funds who are really opportunistic, looking for a quick return. I think those guys will flee. If there's a better investment out there, they will leave. But increasingly, there are pension funds, and there's more and more money in the world looking for an investment. Companies like, or entities, I guess, like the Future Fund are big in this space. They put a lot of money into ILS. They're so big, they basically have to invest in everything. So even if interest rates go up, I think they'll stay in this space. So yes, if interest rates rise, I think there'll be some exodus, but I think there is more than enough money waiting in the wings that will come in if returns in the reinsurance space increase as well, which is looking like it could happen at some stage in the future.
Just one final question from me. Hurricane Irma, it's obviously been big news this week, appears to have created quite a lot of destruction. What do you see as the implication of that for the insurance and reinsurance market? Do you see it as kicking off another rate hardening cycle and for the cat bond market?
Big question. Obviously, it's a very big event for the world. We were sitting here on Friday thinking it could have been even bigger. So actually, from a reinsurance perspective, it wasn't quite as bad as it could have been. Still, it's a major catastrophe. So for the reinsurance market, I don't know if it's going to cause a hardening of rates just yet. It's a little bit too early to say. It's not just Irma. We had Hurricane Harvey a couple of weeks earlier, which is going to be $10, $20 billion on its own. We're sitting here middle of September. The hurricane season goes until the end of November. So actually, there's a lot more risk in the next few months. If we get another big event, maybe that could start to change the market. What's interesting about Irma from an ILS perspective is the US, I mentioned they're very big in the US, so they've got a huge exposure. They're also very big in the retro market, the retrocession market, and they've got a big exposure to this event as well. So this is going to be the first time the ILS market is really tested from a claims paying point of view. And it'll be interesting to see how they respond. So all of that money that's sitting in trust, hopefully those trust agreements work and that money can be released. If for some reason something breaks down there, that's going to be a disruptor for this market. But personally, I don't think that's going to happen. I think the model will work, and if rates start to go up, I think we'll see even more investors come into this space.
I think it's worthwhile doing a sense check on some of the numbers. If you add Harvey and Irma and maybe one more, you might get $100 billion taken out of the cap market. On a bad day, the S&P 500 loses that much. Just mark to market. So we're talking about large amounts of money, but when you add cat risk to the global financial markets, it's actually quite a small portion. And so there's always going to be an opportunity for more capital to come in. And I don't know whether that's going to push price, cause a hardening of the market, but I don't think it's going to cause a disruption to the market.
Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate your insights this afternoon. We've all learnt something in the last hour and we'll go away somewhat wiser and very interested, I guess, in the development of this market. So thank you very much and join me in thanking Stephen and Warren.